Please be aware that in this podcast, we discuss some sensitive topics which some listeners may find upsetting. Hello and welcome to another episode of Tank Nuts. My guest today is an Army veteran who is heading up a project to restore a former British Cold War icon, the Chieftain Main Battle Tank, to its former glory, in an effort to support men and women suffering from PTSD and loneliness. It's Mr. Duncan Mansfield.
Good morning.
Hey, Duncan, how are you? How are you keeping?
Yeah, great. Thank you very much. And thank you for inviting me to join.
Oh, thank you for taking the time out to do it. So, as I said, I first came across you from, your daughter actually got in touch with us, didn't she? Bless her. To say that, you know, be quite interested to come on the podcast. I have to say, I was doing a little reading, saw some of the news reports. But we'll get to that in a minute. So, Duncan, Army veteran, what part of the Army was it that you served with?
I served with the Royal Corps of Transport back in 1980 and served for a total of 5 years. It's strange to only do 5 years, but at the time I was posted back to Aldershot to join the garrison transport. As there was only 20 of us and 20 women, then there wasn't much chance for promotion or anything else. There wasn't much going on in the world at that time in 1985. It was all to change the next year. But at that time, there wasn't much going on. My sister was serving in the Met, was telling me all the stories about what was going on, double the pay, and I decided to swap across to join the Met Police after having served the Army.
very sensible. Why the Army in the first place then? What was the sort of like driving force behind it? I always ask this because I find it so interesting how people have got so many different reasons why they joined the armed forces in the first place.
I served with the Royal Anglian Army Cadets back in the day, back in the 70s, really enjoyed it, but had absolutely no intention whatsoever of joining the Army. But I enjoyed that the life, shall I say. But I was in between jobs one day, and I was walking down Mill Road in Cambridge, because I lived just outside Cambridge at the time, past the recruiting office. And I saw them all sitting in there, saw all the smart uniforms and everything else, and I thought, you know what? Perhaps I should change direction with my life. And I walked in there and signed on the dotted line straight away. And this is what's missing in today's society, I think, is that opportunity to be able to just to walk in and talk to somebody face to face rather than doing it all online, finding out about it and going from there. Without seeing it regularly in the high street, it's not in everyone's faces all the time. And I think this is the big problem with recruiting now.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, my last couple of years in the Army, actually, I was on the long service list and I was recruiting. I was in central London recruiting my last couple of years. And it was just about when I was leaving, it was just about that transition period where they were going from, like you said, if somebody came in and they were interested in the infantry, I had an infanterian who talked to them. If they were interested in tanks, you know, we had somebody from the Armoured Corps and, you know, so on. And then it started to go to all this online stuff. So you're quite right, because what you're not getting is the, you know, those very personal stories from the boys and girls that were serving at the time anyway. A strange old system at the moment. So RCT, I'll be totally honest with you, Duncan, I know nothing about the RCT. It's logistics, isn't it? The Royal Corps of Transport.
Yeah, it was purely logistics, but whether it's from air dispatch, from surface, it could be by sea. We also obviously had our methods of taking vehicles ashore in various locations. When I served in Belize, we had the tank landing craft, this sort of thing we served with. It covers all spheres of the military, basically, is to make sure that all soldiers are fed, they get all the rations, they get their ammunition. Upon joining, I went straight from the depot and training in Buller Barracks to 33 Squadron, based in BOR in Bunda. At that time, it was considered a punishment posting, so I don't know what sure I'd done wrong. But apparently, the idea was they were trying to change it because it had a bit of a reputation as being a bad boys posting. Apparently, I was the first good boy to go there. But it was very disconcerting when you get out there and you're told to go and help that guy that's working on the knocker over there, the old 10-ton lorry. Go and give him a hand servicing it. And you crawl underneath to give him a hand, and he's under there with a yellow handbag drinking Herfy beer at 10 o'clock in the morning. So... Yeah, that was a little bit concerning for me, but certainly Germany was a brilliant posting. But, I think I've lost a thread of what you actually asked me there.
So, Duncan, Belize, one of the places I've never served. What was your experience of Belize?
Belize was an exceptional posting for me because being a soldier, unlike many other soldiers who were serving at the time, I like to feel that I was getting value for money. So I was actually earning my earning my wages. So going to a posting where you could actually do something active to support your wages, basically, was what I really wanted. The same as what the Canada was and Belfast, wherever. You had to feel like you're earning your money. But over in Belize, obviously with the heat, the humidity, the jungle, it certainly was a testing environment. Obviously, we were there to support the Belizean Defence Force, which had just been formed, and the British Army were there to ensure that they were trained up to their respective ranks. My role there, within 3 days of being posted there, I was hollered at by a paratroop sergeant major who called me over to him. Yeah, it was scary. As I went across, I never knew this guy, but he actually knew me because he actually shouted out, he said, "Mansfield, get here." And so he'd obviously been to speak to our RCT depot. And he said to me, "Mansfield, do you know the difference between a brick and a plaster?" I go, "Yes, I'm AJ." He said, "Great, you're now a medic. Get up the hospital." So that was my introduction to becoming a medic, so to speak. Although we were technically only the drivers of the support vehicles, we had a couple of ambulances there, the old Land Rover Series 2 Marshall-bodied ambulances. We also had a couple of GS ones. And what we would do every week, we would take a surgeon, the gas man, the anaesthetist, a dentist, a couple of medical orderlies, and ourselves with a trailer full of supplies, tents, and trestle tables, and we'd disappear in the jungle to various places and carry out routine operations on the locals. Obviously, it was all provided free of charge to the locals, but it gave our troops a chance to practice in the field, so to speak. There were several cases of the trestle tables collapsing with patients on them. And it was nothing major operations. There's only things like piles and things like that because you couldn't do anything major in the field. But it certainly gave the staff a good chance to practice their abilities. So that way, we actually felt like we were actually contributing to the local population, and really earning our money. And that was, you know, it was a great experience. So for the 4 months I was there, I was stationed at the hospital, and we did a lot of work for we covered medical aid for the local Belican beer factory, the local Coca-Cola factory. We would provide them aid, and in return, they would give us supplies. So we would have, the medical staff were never short of beer and never short of soft drinks. It was we were building up for a party one day. And so we had outside, we had a freezer body, a 20-foot container freezer body that was actually supposed to be a morgue. The morgue would hold, was supposedly alleged to hold 40 people. I don't know how you're supposed to get 40 bodies inside this 20-foot container. I don't know. But we use it as a cold store to keep all our beers and things in. And then one day we had a call that there were several serious fatalities at a local place. Somebody decided it was a good idea to turn it up onto freeze, forgetting to tell us. So consequently, the entire contents of our party was destroyed as it all exploded inside the container. But that's one story from there. But it was a great posting. It had some sad moments, but most of it was a good feeling of actually doing something for the community.
And then obviously after that, so you did your 5 years. You then joined, was it the Met Police, did you say? Metropolitan Police.
The Met Police, yeah. Metropolitan Police, yeah.
And how did you find that then, Duncan? That was, it always seems to be, I have to say, one of the things when I was looking at, leaving the armed forces, because, obviously you do as well, we talk to a lot of veterans, and this transition from the armed forces back to civistry is hard, it's really hard. And I think, everybody finds it difficult for their own personal reasons. I always think I was very lucky because my last couple of years, I was doing, this recruiting job in London. So it meant I was almost a civvy, but wearing a uniform still. So I was used to, I had to find my own accommodation. I had to rent a flat and, all the rest of it and got back on there. But yeah, it's a hard transition. So, and obviously the police force, it's quite funny, isn't it? Because how many hundreds of thousands of veterans think that, oh, I'm going to leave the army and go into the police force? And it's not an easy thing at the moment. Funny enough, my son, who's in training at the Royal Marines at the moment, but he wants to go in the police force. He just couldn't get in. There was just no vacancies for absolutely months and months and months.
No, certainly in the current climate, I've still got friends that are in the police. The whole police force scenario has changed and is bending to political will. So that the average copper is no longer the average copper anymore. They've got to get in a totally diverse range of people. And so anyone who comes from the, normal backgrounds that would normally have applied are no longer being considered at this time. And when I joined, I mean, luckily, I was able to go and sit my police exam and everything prior to leaving the army. So I made sure I was accepted into the police before leaving. However, I mean, I actually ended up buying myself out at the time because having been posted back to Aldershot, which was a bit of a dead-end posting, I was expecting to go back and join my regiment in Germany. I'd done my JM. I was ready for promotion. But every stage, because I was always going off in different postings, whether it was to Canada or to Belize, they always said to me, well, if you want to go to these places, that's fine, but you're not going to get promoted because we want the guys that are staying here to carry on the jobs. So I was expecting to go back to Germany, great, get my promotion and then continue with my career in Germany. But for some weird reason, they decided, no, they're going to send me to 41 Squadron in Aldershot. This squadron comprised of 20 guys and 20 girls. All forces, the girls were as well, obviously, and about 40 civilian drivers. And our job was to provide the garrison transport. We would help with the training of the paratroopers, with the even the catering corps or the RCT at the time that were there. And we would provide the transport to take them out on exercises. We would be the enemy, this sort of thing. Although I enjoyed it, I was told quite categorically when I arrived there that there was no chance of promotion and it was a bit of a dead-end posting. So at that time, I thought, well, if I'm not going to get promotion, then it's, you know, I really need to consider my career. My sister was in the job at the time, which is the Met Police. I always call it the job. And the story she was telling me, you know, and the fact that she was on twice the pay I was on, seemed to be quite a good transition at the time. So I bought myself out. But I've got this is one of the big problems, I think, with the armed forces. Even today, as it still goes on, and I've been speaking to a chap from SAFA, an ex-forces chap from SAFA, who now works for SAFA, and he is saying that he has huge problems. He's in charge of guys as they leave forces. If they're already suffering from PTSD or they've been injured in the forces, he's their welfare officer to make sure the transition goes well. But one thing I found, both leaving the army and leaving the police, as you walk away from that place, the door slams behind you. You're no longer welcome. You're not part of that crew. I made a fatal mistake of going back to a friend's party or whatever it was. I can't remember what the circumstances were at the army. And it's almost like you're shunned. You're no longer part of that not tight-knit community. Even though it was only a small squadron we were at, it was, you felt alienated. You know, you couldn't join in the conversations because they were talking job and you weren't part of that job anymore. So that was extremely difficult. And it was even more so when I left the police. I was eventually pensioned out of the police force with injuries that I'd suffered. So again, I went back to another friend's leaving do, and I was completely the outsider, and I vowed never to go back. And I think a lot of ex-forces, you know, they feel that door's slammed and they're now on their own in the cold world. There is no aftercare, there's no after support. There certainly wasn't then, and it's not brilliant now. So, yeah, it was difficult.
So this was all leading up to why you wanted to form this, well, hopefully, we'll come on to it in a minute, but the potential charity to support these people with suffering from PTSD. So it was from your direct experiences, really, yourself, that you thought, do you know what, there's something needs to be done.
Yeah, initially, I had a friend of mine say to me about 3 years ago, luckily, as I'd come out of the army and out of the police force, I started my own companies and I've been reasonably successful at that, which has left me in a position that I've got a bit of plate on, a bit of play money put aside. I heard a story from a friend of mine about this chieftain that was sitting in a field on its own, neglected, and been there for 23 years. Do you want to come and have a look at it? And I thought, yeah. And my wife said to me, she said, you're not going to buy it, are you? I said, of course I'm not. I'm going to go and look at this thing. Of course I'm not going to buy it. What do I want a tank for? So, of course, I went to the field, saw this tank here, fell in love with it, and decided, okay, we're going to restore it. But it was only from moving that forward, I bought this chieftain, we had it shipped back to where it is now, at Raiden Airfield, and we started getting volunteers to say, you know, it went out in the media that we've got this tank here, so I do a little bit of media work now and again. We did an article on it in the local papers, and people started saying, can I come and help you with the chieftain? We formed a group on Facebook to say that, you know, we've restored this chieftain, this is what we do, that's obviously still running. And we started to have all these guys come down to help. All ex, I say 95% of the guys coming down, all ex forces, the Remi, the Tank Corps, all the different regiments from the Tank Corps, and obviously RCT and other units. And as we got, as we started to get this group together, it became apparent that a lot of them were, had issues and were struggling. And I could identify with where they were, having been there myself. And the final crux to it was I had a telephone call from one of the wives who said that their husband had been suffering from PTSD, depression, etc., etc., and had been down for a long period of time. But because he'd been at the Chieftain for nearly a year at that point, he completely reversed his whole outlook on life and on everything, and he just lived for the Saturday so he could get down and be amongst the green stuff again, the machinery, the guys that worked on it. There's a very much a sense of team spirit there. There is a the fact that we you know, we always have a barbecue. We make sure that the barbecue has bratwursts and has Herfy beer, the sort of things that bring back memories for them. We also, as soon as someone's done a day's work in the Chieftain, they get, well, like one of these polo shirts, with a Chieftain with a crew on it. And it says crew on the back. It made them feel like they belong to this group. So we would sit around, we'd have a beer, a chat, we'd swing the lantern and put the world to rights. And the banter was brilliant. It was typical military banter. And so it was from only from when I got that photograph, the light bulb came on. And I said, hang on. We could be doing something with what, you know, we could actually do something to help here, with what we're actually doing and what we're trying to achieve. I mean, initially, obviously, the plan was that we were just going to restore all these vehicles and then, open up a museum of vehicles. But it became apparent that it wasn't the vehicles that were important. It was the people that were working on the vehicles that were far more important. Their well-being, their, they're just the total outlook, to give them a chance to be amongst the green again, as I've already said, and amongst the people that have served with them and who could relate to them and understand them and have been to places that they've been to, dark places as well as places overseas, you know, so that, you know, they could actually talk to them freely and without fear of being laughed at or anything else. So it was that point we decided to make this into a charity, to deal with mental health and well-being of ex-forces personnel. And not just, well, for ex-forces, anyone who's in the position of struggling with PTSD or other mental disorders. And not only that, it's just loneliness as well. We have several guys that live on their own. They see nobody from, you know, from Monday to Friday, and coming out on the Saturday gives them a chance to actually talk to somebody where they may not have a chance to before. So again, it battles loneliness in a lot of ex-forces guys. They've lost their partners, et cetera, et cetera, and they've ended up on their own. So yeah, this is the direction that we now decided to take the group.
And you're saying it's not just the Chieftain. I did chuckle when you said a Chieftain. I mean, of all the things to choose to restore, I did my basic training on Chieftain. I was a Chieftain gunner to start with, and I thought, well, you know, what was it they say about Chieftain? It was the best tank of the era as long as it broke down in a decent fire position. So I thought, well, you've really got your work cut out there for you.
Yeah, I think it had the reputation, or certainly had the reputation for breaking down as much as the Mark IVs, et cetera, did in the First World War, you know, at Cambrai, et cetera. You know, you only get half the fleet to the battlefield, and then the other half will gradually break down as they move up into firing positions. I was very lucky. I mean, my love for the tank comes from Canada. One of my best postings, again, was to Canada, to Battus for 6 months. Yeah. You've probably done Battus. You know what it involves. You know, it's the only place in the world where the British Army can carry out full-scale manoeuvres of live firing exercises in one place. I mean, they spend billions every year. Or they have to. I think it's just closing this year now. But some of these exercises you go on, my role in these was as a driver of the visiting brigadier up to full general, who would be there to oversee the battle group. There was a colonel in charge of the whole battle group, and my job was to stay with the colonel and his driver and bring along the general or brigadier or whoever it happened to be, to keep, you know, to follow the battle as it progresses. And we would regularly find ourselves surrounded by chieftains. We were driving little red top. I was driving a little red top lightweight, and our job was to dodge between these chieftains off-road, going through. I mean, have you actually done a Batters?
Yeah, a lot, a fair few.
Right. You know what it's like then, when the whole place is up in flames from all the, because after the first round is fired, the whole prairie goes up in flames. So you're dodging through flames and smoke, gunfire, the roar of the tank engines. The whole thing is electrifying. It's as close as you're going to get to a real battle, apart from the fact there's no shells coming towards you. But certainly for me, it was an extremely scary experience trying to, because obviously the chieftains have got no chance of seeing you. So if you misjudge and get in front of a chieftain, you're toast. So my job is to dodge between these vehicles, as the battle group advanced across the prairie. Which I really enjoyed. And I've got some great stories about some of the characters that these brigadiers and generals that I had with me. I won't mention names, but some of them were absolutely were crazy guys. We were going forward. I was driving this lightweight, and the trouble is with the lightweight is it struggles to keep up with a long wheelbase Land Rover, because a long wheelbase can ride the ruts much better than a little short wheelbase, because a short wheelbase hits a bump in the ground, and before it knows it, the rear wheels have already hit it as well. So the whole vehicle is shaking and bumping all over the place, whereas a long wheelbase has got that little bit longer for the front wheels to hit first, then the rear wheel. So it's a lot easier for it to go across country. And I was struggling to keep up with this, with the colonel, and I had a brigadier standing up next to me, and he decided he wanted to copy the colonel, and they have the soft top rolled back a bit, and he stands on the seat, holds onto the windscreen. So he can all round view, 360 degree view of what's going on in the battlefield. So he's standing up there, and he reaches across with his right foot, and he kicks me in the side. He said, "Faster, driver, faster." So he's kicking me to go faster. So of course I've accelerated, and I'm just coming up to the infantry lines. And of course, all of a sudden I hit this blind ditch. As well, I was going a little bit slow. I thought, keep out of the, you can only tell there's a ditch because the grass changes colour slightly. And I missed it. I didn't see it. And I hit this ditch, and the front wheels went in this ditch, and the Land Rover stopped dead. And this brigadier just catapulted out of the top of the Land Rover onto the spare wheel and landed a heap at the feet in front of the sergeant major of the, I think it was the Grenadier Guards at the time. Of course, all these Grenadier Guards are trying not to laugh too much into their hands as this brigadier very carefully picked himself up and climbed in and sat down again. But strangely, another instance was the same brigadier coming up again. I think it was to, it was running, I can't remember which infantry regiment it was. Anyway, they're all dug in, it was swelteringly hot. And as we were driving up, the RSM of the regiment comes up to speak to the brigadier. And the brigadier, sort of in a very querulous voice, shouts out, "RSM, why is that man wearing a gas mask?" And the RSM looks across, he looks back at him, he says, "He's not wearing a gas mask, Brigadier." He said, "He's black." He hadn't realised, he thought he was wearing a gas mask. This poor trooper was most put out. Of course, all the rest of the guys thought it was hilarious. But, you know, that's what the infantry's like. But anyway, that's all funny stories. Canada was a brilliant posting.
I would ask you, Duncan, about Medicine Hat. And the tales there, but as your family's going to probably listen to this, and as my family's going to listen to this.
Do you know what? I really went. I only went on about two or three occasions. I was a very hard-working, innocent young man. I didn't partake of alcohol or sex or anything else. Well, that's what I tell my wife anyway. But no, I Medicine Hat. No, it didn't really hold that much attractions to me. I wasn't really a party animal like that, I guess. I wasn't into the bars, you know. Germany, yeah, fine, no problem. The bars in Germany, but no, I'll be one of the ones who was paid as a taxi to give the guys a lift down there. I don't know if you remember, if it's the same when you were there. We used to buy these cars for about $600, and there'd be these huge old American 1960s and 70s cars.
Batters Bangers, as we used to call them, yeah.
Yeah, Batters Bangers, that's right. No, I used to drive them down, the oil spewing out the exhausts. I mean, they were horrendous cars, but they did their job. Anyway, sorry. So I'm probably completely distracted from what the actual question was there.
I don't even remember myself, to be honest with you, Duncan. But all you know about, so yeah, that's absolutely fine. So with the charity, then, Duncan. So it's not just the I know it's not just the chieftain you've got. You've got a fair few other vehicles down there, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, again, what happened as a result of that? We were having so many guys turn up. There were just too many to work on one vehicle. So we decided that, and as there are other regiments there, as well as tank crews, that we decided we'd get a few other and we'd theme it on the BAOR vehicles. So we now have a Saladin, a Saracen, a Champ, Can-Am, Eager Beaver, Bedford MK, and a Coles Crane. Although the Coles Crane doesn't really fit into BOR, although they did serve there, we bought the, it's a 315 Coles Crane with a 19 ton lift. We bought that so we can actually lift off turrets, etc. As well as do any other lifting job, because we were trying to use the stalwart. We got a stalwart as well and a salamander. We just bought the salamander. So we now got the full set of six wheel Elvis vehicles that they built at the time. They built the Salamander, Saracen, Saladin, and the Stalwart. So we've got all four of those. But we were using the Stalwart's crane to do all the lifting. And, of course, it's no match for a lot of the stuff that we do. If you look through the photographs, we so what we did, we actually formed a new group, which is called Battle Group Raiden, which you can find on Facebook. The other one, by the way, is Chieftain 03EB39 Restoration Group. So we have the two groups separate from each other because I didn't want to taint what we originally set out to do with the Chieftain by bundling all the other vehicles into the same group. So we keep the two separate from each other. But there's a lot of, you know, we got about, I think it's about 1,500 followers on the Chieftain group and about 450, I think, on the Battle group. But we also, at the place, what we do now is we have guys that come down during the week. We have guys that come down on the Friday. They then stay over. We have a caravan there that they can stay in, which belongs to one of our founding members, Mungo. He's ex-tanky. Queen's Royal Irish Hussars he served with. He's a very nice chap. He bought a caravan and left it down there so the guys can stay there. We've also got a bar. We built a bar, or Mungo actually built the bar inside. Well, we had bought some porter cabins. We've got a bar and a porter cabins. We've got a briefing room and a tea room, offices where we can keep all the microfiche and all the other equipment. So the guys can come down on a Friday, spend some time in the bar, and they either put a bivouac bag out into one of the offices, or, you know, so they can actually stay. We've actually got a guy with us at the moment who's been with us for nearly 3 weeks now. He's brought his motorhome down from up north. Alan, he is a gun fitter. I'm a gun fitter. He's always saying, I'm a gun fitter. So that's what he does. He's responsible for the gun on the Chieftain, but he's been helping out and all the other projects that we have as well. So, which they all do. They all just get, they're just messing. He just loves it being down there. The airfield has this sense of calm and tranquility. It's an abandoned Second World War American USAAF fighter base. Used to have Mustangs on it during the war. After the war, it was given back to the farmer, and strangely, very little has changed on it. All the big hangars are still there. All the Nissen huts are there. And it's all got now, it's all preserved, so they can't be destroyed or anything like that. So, and they can't build new things on it, which is brilliant. So in the mornings, you can see, you can look out across the fields down to the runway. You see the deer and the hares running around. It just gives you that air of peace there, which is what a lot of the guys like. So they'll stay there overnight, take a chair out and just sit and just watch the airfield go into darkness. Obviously no aircraft now at all. It's, there are other businesses on the airfield, but it's, that's one of the good points about the group as well, is the location it's at.
I mean, it's absolutely fantastic, Duncan. When I first read about it, I thought, what a great idea, because, yeah, like you say, I mean, PTSD, the awareness has changed dramatically, certainly since our day. I mean, I don't recall, you know, we didn't have compression or anything, you know, when you go on an operational tour, you come back, you have a bit of time in, I think they go to Cyprus for a while now or something, don't they? But, you know, we never had any of that. And I thought, what an amazing, you know, incentive to actually get these people together. And obviously, although, you know, it's fantastic what you're doing, as in restoring a Chieftain, et cetera, et cetera. Obviously, this takes a much lesser degree than the fact that you're getting all of these people together again to reminisce. And you know, like you say, yeah, loneliness. I mean, I would imagine, especially considering what the world has you know, been going through and still going through to a certain degree over the last time, it must be even worse at the moment, isn't it? Did you have to stop for the whole of the did you have to stop for the whole of the pandemic thing? I assume it was put on hold everything.
Yeah, pretty much. I've got a guy who's a full-time mechanic with us. And so the place was open because he was the only one there anyway. You know, he would go into work. I'll be in the offices there. I've moved out. I've got my business premises in Ipswich, where my main business is. And I've left that place and I now have an office at Raiden. So I can work from there to keep an eye on everything that's going on there and chat to everyone that comes in. But yeah, that created a big problem. And I know it's certainly affected some of the guys that have been working there. Now they're coming back again. We're now pretty much, you know, getting back to normal where we can when we're working outside. So that is starting to bring back, you know, some life back to these guys again. Actually, to be around them again. The Facebook, luckily, the Facebook groups, because I put a posting up every week, regardless. I made sure every week there was a posting of what's been done during the week, what we've achieved, what we're hoping to achieve. And the guys also, I mean, the thing was, it was supposed to be just about the military side. And that's it. But I've allowed other people to put postings on, our members to put posting on about what they're doing, because I think it's important that it allows them to feel like they're still part of the team. Where normally other groups would have deleted it because it's not relevant to what we're actually doing, like banger racing, for example, or anything like that. If it makes it interesting for somebody else to read. I mean, because the other thing is, the vast majority of the members of the groups are nowhere near us. They're up north. They're even overseas. We've got members in the States. We've got members in Doha. We've got literally any country you can think of. There are members in these countries. There are ex-forces that have spread out across the world now doing different jobs. But they love to follow what we're doing. Germany, we've got some serving guys. One of our very good guys there, Dave Taylor, is still working for Remy at Rock Barracks in, just outside Ipswich. He comes down when he can to help. He's worked on Chieftains, so he knows. He got the pack running. I don't know if you saw the video.
Oh, wow. Yeah, Chieftain, I saw the picture, yeah.
We fired it up. What an amazing thing. That's a funny story as well, because my daughter's all into TikTok, as all kids are. And they say, oh, yeah, I've got, 100 followers now and all this business. And so I said, how do you do it then? They said, oh, this is how you do it. So they showed me how to do TikTok. And, of course, one of the first videos I put up was this Chieftain engine running. And within about 2 weeks, I had 100,000 likes. And it's been going up and up and up more. And they're sick of me now. They go, I can't believe this. I've got more likes than all my daughters put together. I've got four daughters and all my stuff. So they couldn't understand. They said, oh, just bloody typical. You get an old man come along and steals it from the youngsters, you know.
What's the future hold then, Duncan? What are your plans or your dreams for the charity for the future?
One of the... I obviously relate to where these guys are coming from, having been there myself. I've suffered stress disorders while serving in the police, which I'm happy to talk about in a little while. But the way to move forward, how I see this is another big gap, which I think there is between serving soldiers and ex-soldiers and recruitment, is the fact that there is little discussions between all the three groups. I think what we need to do is have more. I'm trying to build up. I'm dealing with, I think it's Omar Barracks in Aldershot. I think it's what it's called. I can't remember the name from my memory's shot. But I'm dealing with a chap there who is with the Gurkhas, serving with the Gurkhas there in the Rimi. And what I'd like to do is organise days where all the ex-forces personnel that I know can go down to an operating barracks to meet the current serving soldiers, to swap stories, to do a bit of fun stuff, a bit of drill, just to give these guys a sense back that they're still part of something, but also to show the youngsters, give them a chance to talk to old soldiers, because you'll find that 99% of ex-forces guys say, I wish I never left the army. Actually, most of them left after 3 years, 9 years, 6 years, whatever. Very few go on to do 22 years. And one of the biggest regrets we always talk about is the fact that I wish I'd made a career of it and done more. They always thought coming out was going to, Civvy Street was lined with gold, and of course it wasn't. It's a cold, hard place. One of my biggest problems when I joined the police from the army, I had this misapprehension that the police officers would be very much like soldiers. Soldiers, you knew your back was covered every step of the way. You knew your mate was watching your back and vice versa. And you loved them like a brother. But not in the police. That was totally different. It was an alien atmosphere. It was, if you talk to any soldiers that went into the police, they'll say the same thing. You could not trust anyone. If you were into a fight situation and it was all kicking off and you turn around, the person you'd gone into, he'd be gone. He'd have done a runner. He wouldn't be watching your back. He'd gone. We had cases of WPCs being left by PCs to fend for themselves in a violent situation. You just couldn't trust them like you could your mates in the army. There wasn't that bond. Everyone was out for each other, out for what they could get for themselves. They weren't out to act as part of a team or anything. And I found that was the most troubling thing. I wasn't sorry to leave the police, and I'm not sorry I don't miss it. I don't miss what it was like. But the army, every day, I think, what the opportunities I had, and I miss this sort of thing. And I think you find the vast majority of ex-forces personnel the same. When they look back and they say, what a great life we had. You know, at the time, of course, you don't remember the times you were sweeping the tank park, you know, constantly out there with a broom, just brushing away as you sweep across the yard. Only then, you know, all your painting leaves green because you had an inspection coming up. Stupid things like that you used to have to do. And if you didn't move, you painted it and all this sort of thing. You don't remember that time, but you do remember the comradeship and the fun that you used to have on exercises, etc. And I think if we could... One of my things is to try to help out. When they do I don't know why they'd never thought of this. When they go to a show, to a country fair or country show, whatever, and they take a recruiting team down, why not invite some of the local groups of ex-forces, whether breakfast clubs or anything like that, to come down as ex-soldiers to give their side of the story as well? Because I think you'll get more joy out of youngsters talking to old soldiers than you will out of talking to a soldier who can't wait to get out of the army anyway. But also it may help to stop the rot within the armed forces by saying to the guys, look, you've got to, you know, bear in mind that Sibby Street isn't paved with gold and it is going to be hard out there. It, you know, where you are now is one of the best places you could possibly be. So I think if we could encourage more cooperation between ex-forces and currently serving, I think it would help considerably. Obviously, there's a lot of bad things going on at the moment with the persecution of soldiers that served in Northern Ireland. Mm. You know, there was a lot of bad things going in Northern Ireland on all sides, and I think by constantly regurgitating it is not helpful at all. So there's a lot of old soldiers out there that are worried about the way things are going and possible prosecutions and things, whereas if we could get them all together... to have some competition between the youngsters and the older ones, I think it would create a great friendly rivalry between the two. And that's where I'd like to see it eventually go. I'd like to encourage more cooperation between the services.
That's fantastic. Duncan, I mean, we won't keep you much longer. I just wanted to sort of, you know, finish up with, now, obviously, we did talk a little bit off camera about your personal experiences of this. And, you know, it's a topic, obviously, you said to me that for a long time, you just couldn't talk about what you'd gone through. So do you think that's half the problem, that people feel that they just can't talk to it? I think it's interesting what you say is, I mean, I get together with with a close group of my army mates occasionally, once a year or something, we'll meet up and, you know, spend the night somewhere and have a few too many drinks and all the rest of it. But you're right, isn't it incredible what you feel you can talk about with two people that you've been through similar experiences, sort of know that environment and what you've been through, as opposed to, I don't know, perhaps somebody who is a doctor or a nurse or a specialist in that subject. I'm not belittling them, of course, by any means, but it must be hard for somebody who's never experienced anything to totally understand what it goes through.
Yeah. I think it's much more prevalent these days with the way the forces are seriously stretched, and they're serving in Iraq, in Afghanistan and other places of conflict. They're under immense pressure. And I was only talking to one of our volunteers yesterday. I had to go down to Sussex on a road trip to collect some parts, and driving with him, he was serving with he did 9 years with Royal Engineers, 7 with the TA. With the TA, he went out to Afghan and got blown up. Invalided out the TA. And when I listened to some of the stories of the things he went through, I didn't suffer these sort of things when I was serving, as most of the guys that I was serving with in that period, there was this gap, where there was nothing much happening. We had the Falklands conflict, obviously, which is a major conflict. We couldn't get involved in. They asked us to join it, but unfortunately we were in training in Northern Ireland, so we couldn't go. They already had an active posting. There was Cyprus was a posting, and obviously Germany, but there wasn't any action, shall we say. There's a lull of, like, for example, everyone of my age normally only has one medal, and that is the Northern Ireland medal, GSM. You know, or they'll get a UN medal. There wasn't anything else at that time. In the full 5 years that I served, there was only those conflicts. So now when you see the young guys these days and they've got 8 medal ribbons up, and you think, good God, you know, the things they must have seen and gone through. I didn't, when I was serving, there were things that took place in Northern Ireland that affected me. There were things that took place in Belize. As I already said, I was part of a field surgical team. Next door to us was F Company, Special Air Service. They were a small detachment there, obviously to monitor the border between us and Guatemala. I had a call out one day that there's a guy seriously injured being choppered in. His Pink Panther had rolled. He's still using Pink Panther. Believe it or not, this is 1980s, and they were still using Series 2 Pink Panthers, the old Series 2 long wheel-based Pink Panther vehicles. And it had rolled, and he'd been badly trapped underneath it. There were circumstances to do with that, but I'm not going to mention that. Rushed out to meet the helicopter coming into the landing pad on the airfield. Now, to go from the airfield back to the barracks is about a six mile road trip, or it's only about a mile across country. And they got the guy, they put him in, and he was looking at me as they put him into the ambulance. As a chap that I had known, that I'd met and got to like. And he put me in, and he was looking at me as he put me in the back of my ambulance. And they said to me, right, okay, you've got to make the decision. He said, he's in a bad way. You've got to get in hospital quick. He said, you either go the road way or go the off-road way. Now, I went the off-road way as quick as I could, got to the hospital, opened the doors, and the doctor got in and said, no, it's too late. He's gone. And for years and years and years, I could not talk about that. He was a friend. And the thought that my decision had cost him his life weighed heavily on me. I never spoke about that. All the time I was in the police until in the Met, I dealt with several nasty incidents, murders, et cetera, et cetera. Very bad car crashes, where kids have been killed, this sort of thing. And one day I was on duty at about 6:30 in the morning. It was raining, and I was parked up in Baltimore Lane in Enfield, and we got a call to say there is a domestic disturbance on one of our very quiet roads that we deal with. So I said, yeah, no problem, I'll take it. I had a young lad with us who'd just joined, and we went out to this house, and as we stood outside this house ready to knock on the door, we heard the most inhuman screaming coming from the house. I'd never heard anything like it. I wouldn't want to hear it again. We had no option. I kicked the door open, ran up the stairs, and in front of us was this guy. He'd obviously completely lost the plot. He was gone, covered in blood. To the right of him was a small bedroom. And I went into the bedroom, and between the bed and the wall, there was a young girl there. She must have been in her 20s. Very pretty girl. She was pretty much naked apart from a pair of underpants on. And she was leaking blood from everywhere, but she was still alive at that point. So the guy was going nutty. By that time, luckily, we had a couple of other crews turn up. They arrested the guy. And I immediately said, okay, I've got to try and save this girl's life. So I went to do heart massage, but as I was pressing down on the heart massage, the chest cavity was caving in. He'd cut with knives through the chest cavity so that it was going in. So I went to give the kiss of life. As I'm doing it, my mouth was filling up with blood from her. And she just died on me. And the worst part about it was, all this time, everything seemed to slow down into very much slow motion. You know, I can recall every minute of every second of what happened at this incident. CID came. Obviously, the guy was dragged out. They said, okay, you stay with the girl. We'll get the undertaker to come out, sort out the things. And everyone left. And all of a sudden, I'm just in this house on my own with this girl. And I walked down to the kitchen. And there was a cup of coffee on the side. This guy had got up in the morning, made himself a cup of coffee, walked to the sideboard, taken out all the sharp knives out of the knife rack, and gone upstairs and just stabbed his wife repeatedly. There's knives all around, a body everywhere. And what was spooky, the coffee was still hot. And I was in this kitchen on my own, deathly silent throughout the house, the poor dead girl upstairs, and this warm coffee in front of me. And that tipped the balance for me. And about 3 weeks later, I ended up on duty one day, and I was in my police car, and I got to the end of the road, and I just didn't stop. I just kept driving. I just disappeared down into Sussex. I was picked up, put into Hendon Police College, where they actually have a small hospital unit there that deals with obviously injured police officers and obviously stress-related injuries. I can remember nothing about the drive. I can't remember Sussex, and I don't even remember how I got to the hospital. But for me, it's one of the worst places they could have put me, because at that time, the last thing I wanted to be surrounded with is uniforms. And of course, there we are, out the window. They've got all the training going on. They've got the drill sessions going on. They still taught drill at those days. And I just wanted to get away. But the guy that treated me, that gave me the help, was extremely good at teaching you how to relax, et cetera, et cetera. He gave a very good analogy of what PTSD is. They describe it that your life, as you go through your life, you have like a chest of drawers inside your mind. And in this chest of drawers, you slowly fill each drawer with every memory that you have, good and bad. Most people in their lives would experience filling up that chest of drawers up to about halfway through. People that work in difficult environments like fire brigade, the armed forces, the police, the nursing, who see violence and see injuries on a regular basis, it is not unusual for them to completely fill their wardrobe up or their chest of drawers up. What happens then is once your chest of drawers is completely full, you have to go back through your chest of drawers to find any space in any other drawers. And it's at this point that the damage starts to happen, because as you start to move about the memories that are in the lowest drawers, they suddenly become vitally important again. And what happened to the trooper in Belize became incredibly important to me. It fired up my memories, what had happened to me in Belfast, what happened to other incidents in my life became extremely important once again. And as a result, this is what leads to the breakdown, because there's just no more room left in your chest of drawers. They teach you, I was lucky enough that these guys here, they teach you to empty this chest of drawers, get rid of these memories, or file them in a better way, shall we say, so you can then face the world again. And within 2 weeks, I was back on the streets. There was no counselling in those days. You just expected to be tough and to get on and do your job. And as the doctor said to me at the time, he said, the people that had the propensity to have these style of, these attacks of PTSD, etc., tend to be the gregarious people, the ones that are always the most fun at a party, the lively people. They have great difficulty in dealing with things, whereas the people that are quiet and are always in the backgrounds tend to be able to protect themselves better from it. But so from these experiences, this has taught me that it's not the vehicles themselves that are important. We didn't want a charity that dealt just as a museum of vehicles. It's not the vehicles that are important. It's the people that are working on them that are important. And these are the guys that we've got to take care of and make sure that they have a happy home life and they can face life again. So that is where I want to take this charity. That is our aim.
Duncan, absolutely fantastic. I mean, since we've I advertised that you were coming on the show, I've had a lot of people get in touch with me. So are you open to new members? And if so, what's the best way for them to get in touch with you?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, we would love to hear from more people. The more people, the merrier. You know, we at the moment, we're at like a troop size. We want to get it up to a regimental size. So
not brigade eventually.
We want to make it a lot better. Obviously, the easiest way to get in touch with us is through the Facebook groups. As I say, if you go onto Facebook and look for Battle Group Raiden, which is R-A-Y-D-O-N, or look for the Chieftain. If you just search for Chieftain Restoration Group, it will come up 03EB39.
Yeah, and I'll put all the links up to you as well anyway, so we'll make sure.
Yeah, that'll be great. I mean, or they can just, you know, try and message me direct or call me. You obviously got my details. I'm quite happy if you want to pass my number on to anyone who wants to have a talk. I'm very happy to talk to anyone. You know, I've been lucky in my life. I have a beautiful wife. I have 4 beautiful girls. And if I can give something back for what I've managed to achieve, then that makes me a happy man.
Thank you so much. Not only obviously for coming on and talking to us, being so open and candid about everything, but obviously what you do as well is fantastic. So from all of us, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
That's great. I'd also like to thank all the volunteers that come up regularly to make this all happen. You know, without them, we wouldn't have a group. So that, you know, it's got to be, you know, it's on their behalf. I'd like to thank them all. Thank you.
And to all of you listening in, thank you so much for your time. If you obviously like the podcast, please leave us a review or subscribe. And until next time, take care.